And ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to another edition of Brew Crew Online. I'm Benjamin Orr, your host, and joining me tonight, staff writer Ryan Connor. We're going to be going over some Brewers news, Brewers notes in the offseason. They haven't been doing too much, but they've been doing enough to stay relevant, at least for a podcast purpose. I'll be talking some other MLB stuff, and later in the show, we'll just be doing some football picks for this weekend. And yeah, it's gotten that bad, at least in the offseason, that we have to do that. So, starting off with the Brewers, let's talk, and I know we've talked about him before, but it's kind of getting to a point where it's really like they haven't brought him back yet, and that would be Corey Hart. He said, you know, a while ago he's willing to come back for less money. Doug Melvin's like, eh, we can wait. And I'm thinking, why? What's the wait? You know, I don't know if they see Ike Davis being a replacement for him, and even then they'd have to trade for Ike Davis from the Mets. Because the Mets have, you know, publicly sort of stated they're willing to shop both Ike Davis and Lucas Duda. But I'm like, they're not any better than Corey Hart, so I just don't get why you won't re-sign him. It's just...
Yeah. Ike Davis, at least, like, one, I don't understand why the Mets would even be interested in Corey Hart in the first place. He doesn't really fit where they are right now because they're not going to be relevant next year because Matt Harvey's elbow is... like, freshly back in one piece. And so 2014 is not the year the Mets should be targeting. And Corey Hart's, you're not going to want to sign him and his raggedy old knees to a multi-year deal. And so I don't know why they wouldn't just roll the dice with Ike Davis. But, like, the more I think about Ike Davis, I mean, that's the kind of play that a team like the Mets or even a case in the Brewers should be willing to kind of take a chance on. But, I mean... yeah, Lucas Duda playing first base for the Mets is just hilarious. The fact that they want to try and take at-bats away from Ike Davis and give them to either Corey Hart or Lucas Duda makes no sense from the Mets' point of view.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of these things, and you do look at other, I guess, possibilities that are out there that other teams throw around, but this one just makes absolutely no sense because it doesn't seem as if Hart is interested in going to another team. He seems dead set on coming back to the Brewers, and... Brewers fans are like, we want you back. Hart's like, I want to be back. And Melvin's just like, eh. James Loney's out there. Justin Morneau is out there. But I'm like,
James Loney.
They're not better options than Hart. Hart fits in Milwaukee. He had a great 2012. He has power. And you have to figure he's going to be in a lineup with Ryan Braun, with Carlos Gomez, with Jonathan Lucroy, with Gene Segura. Hopefully healthy on Ramos Ramirez, provided he's still there. And even, you know, guys like Scooter Gennett and maybe Chris Davis as well. I mean, you have a lineup that can do a lot of damage, and Corey Hart is a big part of that. The reason why the Brewers' offense even stayed afloat this season was because of Carlos Gomez. Because Braun got suspended, Hart was out, Ramirez couldn't stay healthy. So you had a lot of power gone. Carlos Gomez provided that, but if you have Hart there, he helps provide that as well. So I just don't get why... Melvin's dragging his feet through the mud trying to re-sign Hart. It's not like Hart expects a multi-year contract from the Brewers. He just wants to play with us for one more year. And that's fine. Because, I mean, people seem to act like Hunter Morris is dead. Because I never hear his name anymore. And while Hunter Morris probably isn't going to be the player we think he might be, he's still somebody you have to try out. Because he's been a highly talented prospect in this organization for a very long time. So you have to at least try him out at first. And maybe you prep him for that this year so that when Corey Hart is really gone, you have somebody to fill that void. I mean, you also still have Juan Francisco. But I just don't get why bringing back Corey Hart is turning into such a big dilemma.
I think, actually, the more I think about it, the more I actually like the way Melvin is going about this. Because if Corey Hart has basically said, I want to be back in Milwaukee, well... Melvin, so Corey Hart, before he goes anywhere else, is going to come back to Milwaukee and be like, okay, I have this offer. Is this happening or am I leaving? Because he's been very adamant of the fact that he wants to play in Milwaukee for another year. And so I don't blame Melvin for kind of dragging his feet along. One, James Loney is the last person I want in Milwaukee. He's the worst type of player for Milwaukee to sign. He just came off a year that he'll never have again. He's been a terrible offensive player his entire career for first base. And then he goes to Tampa, and the Rays ray the crap out of him, and he becomes good. And then he's going to leave and turn do what Casey Kochman did and just be awful, like Casey Kochman and James Loney actually are. But I don't mind Doug kind of maybe tinkering with the idea, because whether they sign Corey Hart or not is not probably going to make or break the 2014 Brewers team. The team's probably not in a position to contend. So whether or not they get a few extra wins out of Corey Hart instead of maybe a Hunter Morris or whoever else they want to play, that I don't mind them possibly toying with the idea of Ike Davis. Like, the more I think about Ike Davis, the more I actually like that kind of idea, because Ike Davis has upside that nobody else in the Brewers system at first base has. Hunter Morris is, because Hunter Morris has, like, he's not a particularly patient hitter. And I understand Ike Davis strikes out quite a bit too, but Ike Davis also has more power than Hunter Morris has. And so, I don't know, I kind of like the idea of looking at a high upside type. I don't know if the Ike Davis-Nori Aoki thing will actually happen, but I could see a situation where we send Nori to New York, which I have no idea why the hell the Mets would want Nori Aoki, if he makes no sense to their situation whatsoever, other than to just put butts in the seats.
Yeah, I know that the Mets are desperate for an outfielder, though, and I think Aoki's right up their alley because he's a leadoff hitter. He's, you know, a subpar defender in the outfield.
And he's dirt cheap.
Oh, very. I mean, the Brewers are paying him $2 million for this year. $2 million for a guy who can put up 280.
When it comes into negotiations, I think Melvin can basically come out and say, okay, well, you're... Because, honestly, the more I think about this, the more I actually want Ike Davis in Milwaukee. Like, initially when it came out, I was like, Ike Davis? Wow, this is awful. But then I actually went and did some digging on Ike Davis, and I was like, well, this could be kind of the right high upside play that a team in the Brewers' position should be making, because they basically, the team in 2014 is going to need a lot to go right to compete, particularly on the pitching staff side, with Gallardo actually showing that he was the Gallardo he was post-hamstring injury, that he was awful before the injury occurred. And so I don't know if necessarily counting on Ike Davis to be the Ike Davis he was after he came back from the minor leagues as before is kind of a similar situation. So you're looking at, you know, multiple things would have to go right anyway. And so getting a guy who, Ike Davis, he has all-star first baseman potential. Like, he is that kind of a hitter when he plays well. I mean, people forget he had over 30 home runs in 2012 and at Citi Field. So that's no small feat in itself. So there's a lot of upside in Davis. So you send Aoki to New York, which they're just going to use him to plug and fill seats because they're not contending. And because you say, well, you're getting a lot of value and he costs nothing, that's extra, that's like extra leverage to get you Ike Davis and a lowerish kind of lottery ticket type prospect. Like, I'm going through the Met system right now and I'm seeing, I mean, they have a lot of flamethrowing guys, guys low in their system. And, I mean, that's the kind of guy that you like to target, and basically you take him, which the Brewers have been kind of drafting this type of guy, is take the guy who throws 96-plus, and we're going to teach him how to pitch, which often ends up giving you a lot of bullpen arms, but getting bullpen arms that are very cheap is very valuable, because then you don't have to go out and sign Tom Gorzolani, who is, like, our fifth highest-paid player, and he's basically, like, his ideal role is that of a left-handed specialist. And so, I mean, I could see, I kind of like the way Doug is playing this, honestly. I think that in the end, Corey Hart ends up in Milwaukee, and this was all just a show, but I don't mind Doug kind of entertaining the idea of going for higher upside over the kind of some as much certainty as you can have with an injury-prone first baseman.
Yeah, but is there really upside to Ike Davis? Because while he did have 32 home runs in 2012, he also had a batting average under .230. And to me, that just spells another case of Ricky Weeks. And looking at where Davis has been in his career, he did well in 2010, had a phenomenal 2011. But granted, that was only in 36 games. I mean, he did hit over 300. Mm-hmm. But when you play Ike Davis in almost a full season, he hits below .230. And to me, that's a combination of what the Brewers were getting out of Matt Gamble and Ricky Weeks. And that's something I think they need to avoid, because that's what they keep on bringing up. And that's what I see in Sean Halton. That's what I see in Taylor Green. That's what I see in Jeff Bianchi. Now, while they are more versatile than, say, a Gamble or a Weeks, they're just backup players. And I'm not saying Davis is a backup player. Davis is definitely a starter. But after this very, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, this very horrid 2013 he had, it raises a lot of questions. And I don't know if you really want to roll the dice on somebody like that. I get that, you know, like you said, Melvin is entertaining the thought of it. But at the same time, it's just, you know, if it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. Quit dragging it out more than it needs to be, and just get Corey Hart so he can focus on other parts of this team that need fixed. Maybe try, after you sign Corey Hart, to possibly shop Yovani Gallardo or Ramos Ramirez or Ricky Weeks. Try to get something going there. It may not work, but if you give it more time, it might, because that gives you, that frees up more salary that you can work with for, you know, bullpen arms, maybe another starter, maybe a third baseman. Who knows? But, I mean, I get what Doug Melvin is doing. I just don't like it because I feel like it's wasting time.
Well, I just was looking at Ike Davis, and basically his low batting average in 2012 was basically entirely BABIP induced. He had a BABIP of 246, which is insanely low. Like, that has no business sustaining itself. And the other 2 years he posted BABIPs over 300, and so I think I'm slowly here during the podcast jumping on the let's get Ike Davis bandwagon, because that's apparently seemed to really be undervaluing. Like, there's no reason the Mets shouldn't be trying to get rid of Ike Davis. They should be holding on to Ike Davis in hopes that he becomes the Ike Davis that he was supposed to be. But I mean, and I think Melvin can simultaneously deal with this Corey Hart thing while attempting to shop low, because you're not moving Gallardo for, you're selling really low on Gallardo, and I don't think a good GM would be trying to sell Gallardo. I think you hope that Gallardo returns to being a good pitcher, which I don't know whether I should be confident in that or not, but you can move Loesch now because it's hard for his value to get a lot higher, especially in a market where you have Ervin Santana asking for $100 million, which of course he's not going to get, but
yeah, that was crazy.
He'll get much more than he's worth. But you try and move Loesch now, who's basically a 2-year, $22 million contract, and that's really cheap for a number 2-3 starter. And like, he ranked over the last, or since 2011, he was 17th in Major League Baseball in ERA, which ERA in 1 year is kind of a little bit misleading, but 2 years is at least a good enough sample size to be like, okay, this guy is obviously a good pitcher. He may not be a top 30 pitcher, but he's a good pitcher for sure. So you can still move Kyle Loesch, or, you know, try to shop Kyle Loesch to a team like the Orioles or something, while still, you know, allowing this first base situation to kind of play itself out, to see if you can back the Mets kind of into a corner where they missed out on the outfielders they wanted, because the Nori Aoki thing is not the first thing that's going to get done by the Mets. The Mets are going to go and they're going to look at other outfielders, and they could possibly look to Nori Aoki after that point. And so I think it's fine for Melvin to be slow playing this.
You know, and let's talk about, the Brewers trying to shop players in particular. And, you know, you bring up Loesch as being one of the people they could possibly shop. I do agree with that. I think he's probably the best person on the Brewers market, providing they were going on the market to trade people. I think Gallardo, there's two ways about going with Gallardo. You either shop him now, and you could still get something for him, because many GMs aren't going to downplay one year as the tire value for the guy. Now, some might not. Maybe you wait it out, see how he is around July next year, and then maybe you try to get something for him before his contract runs out. I don't know. For Loesch, it's hard, because while you could get something for him, he's one of these players I don't think really needs traded, because without him, this Brewers rotation is absolutely lost. And, you know, so many people are going to tell me, well, it doesn't matter, they're not contending anyway. Well, they're not going to contend at all if Loesch is gone. They're not going to have anybody, because Willie Peralta was so hot and cold last year. Gallardo was very hot and cold last year. Loesch was the guy to go to. And then beyond that, the rotation was either hurt or they had nobody. And I guess I'm forgetting Marco Estrada, but Marco Estrada had a really weird season.
And, yeah, he did.
I mean, it's literally a tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Marco Estrada. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily opposed to trading Kyle Loesch. I'm not opposed to it, but at the same time, I don't really want to see that happen, because if this team wants a shot at least contending, you need to bite the bullet and keep somebody. That's why you need to try to shop Ricky Weeks, you need to try to shop Garrido if you can. And if you can, and this is a stretch, try to shop Aramis Ramirez, but I don't know who's going to really want a guy who was out three times this year because of his knees. But with that, I mean, you create some sort of market that, let's face it, there's going to be some team like the Rockies, some team like the Padres, some team like the Orioles that's going to be desperate for pitching, and they're going to look at either Loesch or Gallardo, one of the two. They're not going to say, well, I want this guy and I don't want this other guy. If you're the Rockies, you're going to want either one of those guys. It doesn't matter who.
Oh, they would. Oh, I can't even imagine Gallardo in Coors Field.
He'd be terrible.
Home runs ever.
Home runs for everyone.
Like, and if he faced the Cardinals at Coors Field, could you imagine the home runs?
They'd probably bring in hot dog guys to start hitting home runs off of him.
That's something that to this day I still don't understand, how he can be so terrible against the Cardinals and then, you know, still not anywhere near as bad against every other team. Yeah. But looking at the market, moving Loesch is all about getting proper value. If they're getting offers you, you know, a solid package of prospects, and I'm not talking, Loesch isn't a guy that I'm going to take lottery tickets for. I need someone who is like, okay, this person has a very high percentage of being an above-average major league player, because you're not going to get a future star for Kyle Loesch. But if you can give me a guy, okay, this guy's going to be an above-average major league player, and then a lottery ticket in low A who throws 96 but doesn't really know how to pitch yet, then I take that for Kyle Loesch. But if we're getting low-balled for him and they want to give you fringe major league talent, or they're just throwing low A guys at you because there's still low A guys that you're like, okay, this guy has a high chance of being a productive major leaguer. I mean, Byron Buxton's was a low A guy, and if you throw me Byron Buxton for Kyle Loesch, I accept the trade and then I admit you to some sort of psych ward.
Just kind of like the Angels when we got Gene Segura.
Right, there's a package that you could construct for Kyle Loesch that would take in a heartbeat. But I don't want to get lowballed on Kyle Loesch. I don't think moving Garrido right now, I think GMs are concerned because his velocity has been down significantly since 2 years ago. He's lost a little over 3 miles an hour, I believe, in the last 3 years on his fastball. He's throwing more two steamers, which isn't working because, one, his mechanics are kind of a mess, and two, he throws very over the top. And so it's hard to generate a lot of movement with a two-seamer when you throw over the top like that. And so he's losing velocity, and he's not really benefiting with a lot of extra movement. And that I noticed one thing, if you notice the year difference of the last 3 years, is he's been throwing significantly more two-seamers last year, and it didn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And his command was traditionally subpar and was again subpar. And then all of a sudden he was throwing slower with subpar command. He kind of got destroyed. And so I think at least smart GMs, I mean, you could sell Guyard to the Phillies and they'd think he's God because Ruben Amaro has next to no clue what's going on. But, I mean, any rational team will be like, okay, all their analysts are going to be like, this guy's losing velocity, he's throwing more two-seamers, it isn't working, and the GM is going to listen to that guy because it's pretty easy to reach that train of thought. And so you need to, I think, in order for Guyardo to get the value you want for Guyardo, you need to let him pitch a half a season and be like, okay, over the last 11 months, he's been, you know, what Yovani Garrido had been, you know, from 2009 to 2012, and not what he was for three quarters of 2013. And they should be trying to remove Ricky Weeks for any kind of salary relief they can get. Like, I move him for that and a player to be named later that I will never hear about. And I do the same thing for Aramis Ramirez. I move him, and I hope I can pray to God I can get someone to pay some of that deferred money for a player to be named later that I'll never hear from again. Because the salary relief for those two is worth getting nothing. Just the salary relief itself is worth it, because those are, because we're going to be paying Aramis after he's gone. We're paying Weeks to be a below replacement level player because he can't play defense at all anymore. And if he can't make any sort of contact, then that's just, then he's a mess offensively. We already have a guy who can at least play two thirds of second base. And you can, whether you want to bring in a guy to play, to platoon with him, or just roll with Jeff Bianchi, you can do that and it won't, you know, kill you. And so they should be trying to move Ricky Weeks for any sort of salary relief they can get. And the same thing for Aramis Ramirez. They should be waiting on Gallardo, and they should move Loesch if the right package comes along, but don't allow yourself to be lowballed.
Yeah, I think I can agree with that. I mean, try and sell Weeks and Ramirez as fast and to whoever you can. I will sell them for a bag of combos and some Skittles.
Combos are delicious, as are Skittles. That's way too high a price.
Product placement. No, but
I would sell them for a thing of Smarties. Nobody likes Smarties. Smarties are everywhere, and nobody eats them.
Yeah, I have to agree there. I don't care for Smarties. You know, I also don't care for Tootsie Rolls.
I have, out of a thing of candy I got for Halloween, the only thing I haven't eaten are Smarties and Tootsie Rolls.
Good man.
Because, I mean, Tootsie Rolls are like a like a rubbery version of chocolate.
They're an abomination.
And Smarties are basically just, like, they're supposed to be, like, sugar circles, but they don't really taste like anything.
They're like the roast beef of chocolate. Because roast beef, I think, in the way you can cook it, takes forever to chew sometimes, which is the way Tootsie Rolls taste.
You need to cook your roast beef better.
Yeah, I probably should.
Either my family is just significantly better at cooking roast beef, or you're just doing it wrong.
It's too chewy. But aside from the point from okay. How we prepare our foods, but that's the point. I mean, I would sell Weeks and Ramirez for significantly low due to the fact that that's so much salary you free up, and you can tinker around with, you know, open money then. And which leads me to the next thing I want to talk about is we had a roundtable come out yesterday. Or today. I don't know.
A certain day that was either earlier this week, today, or perhaps later.
Yeah, it was this week. So we had a roundtable come out this week that talked about the future of where the Brewers are going to go with this, and that meaning the hot stove months, what's the future going to look like in 2014. And it's kind of interesting because the Brewers haven't really had their hands in the cookie jar when it comes to free agency. They always kind of shy away from it, unless it's signing Kyle Loesch in, you know, March. They haven't really been anywhere related to free agency in the past couple years. And if they do get rid of the salaries of Ricky Weeks and Aramis Ramirez, that frees up money. So, and I know we talked about, you know, what we think they should do, and you said, Ryan, you said that they should at least try to move Nori Aoki. But is there anybody
you would like Davis.
Is there anybody you would like to see them sign that's a free agent that could possibly help this team?
There's just the free agent class this year is just so just doesn't fit. I mean, there's I guess Scott Kazmir, depending on the price, I guess is the most like I'm so conservative when it comes to free agency. Like I'm basically the Oakland A's, where I just look for a guy who came off a really crappy season or a guy who's, like, really undervalued. Like, if B.J. Upton was a free agent right now, I would be all over B.J. Upton. But it's – I mean, Kazmir, I guess, because people are still going to be very hesitant about – and, like, rightfully so about his – you know, the fact that he disappeared and was gone for, like, 4 years and then all of a sudden returned to be a successful starter. But – I mean, there's Kazmir. There's just the free agent class is so, like, I'm looking through it right now, and it's just so uninviting. Like, there's no way I sign Justin Morneau. You could not pay me to sign Justin Morneau. I want nothing to do with Kendrys Morales because he's a DH only who has a draft pick attached to him. So there's no first baseman outside of like Corey Hart that makes sense. I will not sign James Loney.
I mean, there's Mark Ellis, who Lou thinks that I have a giant man crush for, but I'm just playing devil's advocate.
It's okay. It's okay if you do. We're not going to judge you.
I'm just playing devil's advocate. He's a quality player, and if I were the Oakland A's, I would be trying to bring him back. Yeah, third base. I mean, assuming that in this case Ramirez would be gone, and he's not getting all of his salary paid for. You're just hoping for some salary relief. There is not a single third baseman outside of Juan Uribe, who I don't know if he actually leaves the Dodgers, that should be starting on a major league team next year. They are terrible. This class is awful. The next best guy is Eric Chavez. And he's still, he's only 36. I feel like he should be significantly older. His knees are 85. And, the Brewers don't need outfield help, so... And then you're looking at pitchers of... I mean, you're looking at guys like Arroyo, who I don't want. Scott Baker, who's a buy-low type guy. So if you're looking at actually spending money on the free agent market, you're looking at, Bartolo Colon, but do you really want a ground ball pitcher with the infield defense that the Brewers are going to be sporting, regardless of, who they pick up? They still have Segura, who's... at best, slightly above average, and at worst, kind of below average-ish. He's a fairly average defensive shortstop. You got Jeanette, who's not good. Ramirez is awful, but assuming Ramirez is gone, you're looking at probably no better than anything average-ish. And then first base, whether it's Harder Davis or Francisco, it's not good. And so you don't want to put a ground ball pitcher in front of that. They're not going to be in the market for a Garza. You could maybe make a case for Dan Heron, but he has home run problems, and Miller Park is not the ideal place. There's Tim Hudson, which I guess that would kind of make sense if they were trying to compete in 2014. So, yeah, I'm looking at maybe Hudson and Kazmir as really being the only viable options, and I don't want to spend any money on the bullpen. So, yeah, I mean, Hudson and Kazmir, I guess, if we're going the free agent route, because there's not a lot there. The deepest position in free agency is the outfield, and of course we have zero desire for any outfielders.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really inclined to believe with you there, is that there's no room in the outfield. The outfield is set. I mean, no matter how you look at it.
It's beyond. We have a surplus of outfielders right now.
Yeah, I mean, outfield is set, catcher is set, second baseman is set, shortstop is set. So you're only, I guess... pieces you have to play with in the infield or your corner positions. But, I mean, even then, that's something I think you can work internally. I think, like you said, pitching is probably where they need to work. And I wrote a few articles the past few weeks. I wrote one about Scott Kazmir being a possible, free agent for them that they could sign on their maybe on their radar, maybe Tim Hudson. I don't know why I wrote one about Chris Capuano. I just feel kind of silly writing that. I think if they go bullpen help, they do need a left-hander, because I just don't think one left-hander in Gorzolani is going to cut it. I mean, he is the only left-hander in the entire roster. So maybe like a J.P. Howell, maybe like a Scott Downs, Boone Logan, they're out there. It might get a little bit pricey. But I think if you want to spend money on a reliever, I think your best bet, honestly, is J.P. Howell. I would really like to see the Brewers at least talk to him. I wouldn't have any problems signing Scott Kazmir. I think Kazmir is back, and I know he showed signs of that this year with the Indians. He started off a little rough, but after around mid-May to the end of the year, he was one of the Indians' better pitchers next to Masterson and Danny Salazar. So I think the Brewers could look his way. I think they could look Tim Hudson's way as well. But I honestly don't see the team doing a lot. And this is a case of not because they're a small market team, but because a lot of the holes are filled. A lot of positions are filled, and they don't really need to go into free agency. They can for one or two things. I still think they need a fifth starter. I still think they need another bullpen arm. And that's really it. I mean, if you want to go internally for third base, you do have Ramos Ramirez. You could put Taylor Green there, since he's not back.
Taylor Green.
I know, Taylor Green. You could put Jeff Bianchi there.
Wow, our third basemen are really not going to hit.
Yeah, I know, that's the sad thing. You either have, Aramis Ramirez is out five times a year because of problems, or you have Bianchi and Green, who could probably hit a combined 230.
Hey, but they'll be gritty.
They'll be gritty, so...
They'll be just straight up Kirk Gibson, all up on that.
They'll be gritty, so, you know, we do have that, but there aren't many options, at least in the infield, that the Brewers need to go for, because if Hart's back, then your entire lineup is pretty much set except for third base.
Or if they get Ike Davis.
Or if Davis, yeah. One of the two.
Watch the Tampa Bay Rays get Ike Davis and him hit like, him go like 280, 390, 540.
He'll have like 35 home runs and just a BAP of like 320. And
He'll win the Silver Slugger at first base. And he'll finish third in MVP voting ahead of Mike Trout because, you know, screw Mike Trout apparently.
Every baseball writer is going to take their computer and throw it out the window because the narrative will just be destroyed. Ike Davis will be like the next coming of like Ty Cobb. And he'll be like, and it will be like, we could have had him.
We should start titling these podcasts, and this title would just be Ike Davis is the next coming of Ty Cobb. And that would basically sum up this podcast in one sentence.
It would.
But yeah, I mean, looking at the free agent market, it doesn't really fit what the Brewers would even look for. And this starting pitching market, like outside of like Kazmir Hudson, is a disaster waiting to happen. I know Nolasco's got the odd FIP kind of case where his FIP was really good and his ERAs were terrible, and then it's starting to come closer to his FIP. But I still have this distrust of Nolasco, especially for the money that's being out there for him. Irvin, if you're betting on Irvin Santana, you're crazy. That dude was trash 2 years ago. Josh Johnson, he's still got the fact that he can be an ace, so that's going to push him out of what the Brewers will pay. As far as relief pitchers, I've kind of learned, like, I normally would want to be like, okay, you need to have a left-handed reliever going on, but they have Gorzolani, who can make it work against lefties if you want to do matchups, but the Loogie is really only a necessity in October, and so if the Brewers are in a position where they're contending, or they're like on that, you know, if they're only a couple games out of the wild card in July, which I guess would be contending, you know, if they're within four games or something, they can go out on the trade market. There's 800 left-handed relievers available in July, and so if that's something that they really need to add, then they can do it then, because otherwise, for a lot of the season, I feel like you're kind of burning a roster spot for a guy who throws one out a game.
Yeah, but the Brewers aren't really known for, you know, loogie situations. Especially the way the rotation went this year, they've had to have their bullpen pitch, you know, sometimes 4 or 5 innings a game. And, I mean, I do get that because you do see a lot of teams use that specialty, a lot of more your contending teams, because they have room to play with for that. Which is why I think if they don't go for, like, a J.P. Howell or somebody, that's why they need to go for Scott Kazmir. Then that way they have another left-hander in this, I guess, pitching staff as a whole, because Kazmir is a left-hander and he's a starter, and that's something the Brewers don't have, as a left-handed starter. The last one they actually had in this rotation that was a part of it was Chris Narvison. So that's why they need to go after, at least entertain the thought of going after a Kazmir or somebody, because you need a left-handed presence somewhere. Maybe I overvalue that, but I think it's something this team at least needs.
I'm not sure if we necessarily, like, the difference, basically, I know there was a study that I was reading about, like, whether having a multifaceted rotation, like lefty-righty and, like, being able to mix it up really made much of a difference, and it was basically, like, inconsequential. But I understand, like, wanting to have, I mean, I want, the reason I would want to bring in Scott Kazmir is because he's a pretty good pitcher. And J.P. Howell, well, he has been a fairly decent pitcher, but I'm just not sure that... The thing is, J.P. Howell could sign, and then the Brewers could trade him for a guy that we've never heard of in July, if we have to. And I just don't know if it's worth burning the few million dollars, which instantly puts him, like, in the top 7 on our payroll, to be a one-out guy for 4 months when we can pay him that for 2 months if we're actually competing.
That is fair. So, I would like to see the Brewers do something. I don't know what it is.
Give us something to write about. Give me Ike Davis.
Or better yet, give you Mark Ellis.
Give me both.
Oh my god, what would they do with Mark Ellis and Ike Davis?
Ike Davis would become the National League MVP, and Mark Ellis would play third base when Ramirez got hurt and hit 320 with an on-base of 440 and make the All-Star team. And I'm sticking to that.
You know, I mean, realistically, now that I actually think about it, and I know how much flack you got for this, Mark Ellis would not be that bad of an option at third.
Thank you! He's not that bad!
He really wouldn't be that bad of an option now that I think about it. I mean, he's not going to be like David Wright good. Oh my god, why do we keep making references to the Mets here?
Ike Davis?
Ike Davis? No, but I mean, he's really not that bad of a player. I mean,
no, he should be starting on a major league team every single day. But for some reason, he gets undervalued so badly.
And the thing is, like, you wouldn't even know he's 36 years old. That's the thing. Like, Aramis Ramirez, you can tell, is his age. Mark Ellis is still putting up a decent average. I mean, he doesn't exactly, you know, drive home the point, you know, with a lot of the bigger stats. But you don't need him to when you have everybody else on this team and their mother who can hit bombs. I mean, he's a nice plug-in option. He's not the future of third base. He'd be nice for, you know, 1 or 2 years at third before we get somebody. Which, that's the thing, is the Brewers don't really have anybody in the minors, at least at the moment, that can play third base.
You're talking, like, third baseman? You're either hoping that Clint Coulter can handle third base out of catcher, which they're, like, from what the little banter I've seen about it, has said that he's either a catcher or a first baseman, probably, which is, like, the worst thing you can possibly hear. Because the catching reviews are not good. Or you're looking at Tucker Newhouse, and he is, like, 19 years old.
Yeah, we just drafted him, so.
Yep, so there's that.
Or there's that guy we got in the trade with K-Rod from Baltimore, Nick Delmonico.
Oh, yeah, Nicky Delmonico, yeah. And then there's, he was in my little self-plugging here. If you haven't checked it out, check out my top prospects. I have dropped a couple little scouting terms in there with Arcia and Taylor, I know for sure. But yeah, talk about Nicky Delmonico a little bit. His swing is very violent. There's a lot of raw pull in his swing. He's got he generates a lot of power through the zone, but he strikes out a ton. And hoping strikeouts can kind of decline as he goes up, that usually happens, but he has some... by his swing, you can tell he's extremely pull happy, but he can still be a quality major league third baseman even if he doesn't really change his offensive approach and he just, you know, progresses upon the approach he currently has. If he can actually play third base, which is the question, is Nicky a third baseman or a first baseman? You know, I mean, because the fact that you have a 60 grade name doesn't really let you play third base.
No, it really doesn't. And, I mean, he didn't do all that well this year in the minors, but I don't like to base how well a guy's going to do on one season, especially when it's, like, around his first.
Right.
So there are some options there, but they're still years off, which, I mean, I guess is why Mark Ellis would be a nice plug-in option, but I don't know if that's actually going to happen, because that would require the Brewers getting rid of Aramis Ramirez, and...
Yeah, we're talking about a thing that's probably not even... Because I don't even know if anyone wants Aramis Ramirez.
Oh, there's somebody out there that probably wants Aramis Ramirez.
You know the Phillies want Aramis Ramirez to play third base.
Who is their third baseman?
Excuse me, Mr. Amaro. I'm willing to offer you Aramis Ramirez. And in return, I would like Dominic Brown. Thank you.
We'll even throw in Ricky Weeks for free, because Chase Utley needs days off too, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll throw in Ricky Weeks, but in return, we are gonna need some prospects here. Let me see. The thing is you ask for prospects from the Phillies, and you're like, "Well, there are none." And Ruben's like, "What the heck's a prospect?"
Oh, you're supposed to draft people that are actually worth something? Oh,
wait, you're telling me that I'm not supposed to lose all of my draft picks by signing aging free agents? I mean, here's basically what's going to happen, sir. I'm going to give you Ramos Ramirez and Ricky Weeks, and you're going to give me Michael Franco, Jesse Biddle, and Dominic Brown.
He'll stretch
his
head.
And he's like, well, Aramis Ramirez is an elite caliber third baseman, and Ricky Weeks has a lot of power, and Chase Elliott will need days off. And I think in a pinch, Ricky Weeks could play shortstop.
Oh my god. I would love to see that.
Can you imagine Ricky Weeks playing short, Aramis Ramirez playing third, Michael Young playing second, and Ryan Howard playing first?
Isn't Michael Young with the Dodgers?
Michael Young will end up back with the Phillies, I promise.
Huh.
It will happen. Because there's no reason for Amaro to even sign Young in the first place. He's going to make sure that Young gets back to Philly.
Wow. Yeah, that would be something. Huh. Well, I want to get on a rant now because I think we've finally beaten the horse with the Brewers because...
Ike Davis.
We've beaten the Brewers with the Brewers and Ike Davis. And so the one rant I want to get into is something that I think Ryan and I both agree with. And there's no other way to put this, but I'm sorry, Miguel Cabrera does not deserve the AL MVP.
Thank you!
He just doesn't. MLB on Fox posted something earlier, you know, like, hashtag MVP Trout, MVP Cabrera, MVP Davis, which Davis was a complete joke anyway, for who you picked, and I said MVP Trout. And some guy replies to me, he goes, Trout plays for a losing team, get over it. And I just wanted to throw something out the window because...
Was that the guy that was tagging us in the tweets that got into an argument with?
No, that's a different guy. This guy just tweeted at me once. And I'm like, okay, no, it doesn't matter because if we give little awards for teams that sucked, Felix Hernandez would have not won the Cy Young Award 3 years ago when he won 13 games and Seattle was terrible because they didn't base it on the wins. They based it on his sub 2.30 ERA.
And Zach Greinke
with the Royals. It's just, it's an individual award very comparative to the Cy Young. And I'm sorry,
it's the exact same award, but yeah. It's like you can include both hitters and pitchers.
Yeah, because Justin Verlander won it.
Yeah,
so
that almost never happens. It's basically the best position player award.
And I don't know how many of you out there listen or watch MLB Now with Brian Kenny, because I am a huge
Brian Kenny. That's my man right there.
Brian Kenny is one of my favorite analysts, and how he can do a show with Harold Reynolds, I don't know. But Brian Kenny has this philosophy of kill the win for pitchers, which I totally agree with. But there is a stat I think should be killed more than the win for pitchers, and that's RBIs. I hate RBIs. They are
Make
not
them a die.
Because people will say, oh, well, Miguel Cabrera had 137 RBIs and Mike Trout only had 97. Okay, well, look at this. Look where Cabrera hits in the lineup comparative to where Mike Trout hits. Mike Trout is a leadoff hitter on a terrible team that nobody ever gets on base, where Cabrera, everybody's on base for him. I mean, you have to look at the scenarios. And you look at Mike Trout's WAR of 9.2. The second person behind him in all of baseball was our very own Carlos Gomez. So, I mean, and then you don't even factor in defense? I mean, come on. That's what kills me, is they don't factor in defense at all. And Trout is miles ahead of where Cabrera is. And it's just, it's completely asinine. It just is. Because, oh, well, Cabrera had a better slash line and more home runs. And okay, yeah, he can do that when he plays on a team that gives him a chance. And when he plays teams like, you know, the Royals. Well, the Royals were actually pretty decent this year. But, I mean, teams like the White Sox, who have no pitching, the Twins, who have no pitching. He plays them a ton of times a year. Whereas Trout has to face the A's, the Mariners, the Rangers. I mean, come on. That's not even, like, something you can even argue about. It's no joke that Cabrera has an easier time when he plays in their division. Trout does not, and Trout still finds ways to get on. I mean, there are more things that I could argue with in Trout's case, and people are still going to say that I don't know what I'm talking about and that Cabrera wins because he plays for Detroit. Well, yeah, he won because he plays for Detroit, and they're a winning team. And I hate baseball purists that think, well, because he made it to the postseason, he deserves to be MVP. That is crap. I mean, now, in the case of Andrew McCutchen winning, I'm fine with that. Yeah, I probably would have voted for Paul Goldschmidt myself, but I'm fine with Andrew McCutchen winning it. But as for the AL, Trout got screwed 2 years in a row.
Oh, he got screwed. Like, I'm glad you made this rant because I was coming into tonight going to make the same rant. And basically, so people have an understanding of the difference, if you go by wins above replacement, which if you choose to totally disregard this stat, you're ignorant and it's a very stupid thing to do because people have studied for decades as to what makes baseball performance objective. And these are the formulas they have. This is the formula they have come up with. So if you're arguing this, you're arguing with people who have done decades of research to decide that, okay, this is the best we can do right now to value player performance. And it's pretty in-depth. And so you're looking at the difference between Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera just this year was Jonathan Lucroy.
Yeah.
Mike Trout was Jonathan Lucroy better than Miguel Cabrera. He wasn't Jeff Bianchi better than Miguel Cabrera. He wasn't even, like, Chris Davis's short little time in Milwaukee better than Cabrera. He was an all-star quality catcher better than Cabrera. It wasn't close. And last year, the gap was even bigger.
Like, I just don't get how they justify giving Cabrera the MVP. I'm not taking anything away from Miguel Cabrera. He's a fantastic player. But I'm sorry, you can't name me one player in baseball currently that is better than Mike Trout. I'm sorry, you can't. At least that's my opinion. I don't think there's a better player than him.
I believe it is fact, actually.
It very well might be fact.
It is fact.
Because it's just...
And it's not even close. He's significantly better than everyone else. I mean, the next closest guy in wins above replacement this year was Andrew McCutchen at, I believe, like, just a little bit over 8.
No, it was Carlos Gomez.
Was it... Well, which one are you using? Are you using Fangraphs or are you using... Baseball Reference? Because I use Fangraphs for all my stuff because I like the things that go into theirs a little bit better. Especially with... Most so with pitching, but...
Oh, I was using Fangraphs. Not Fangraphs, Baseball Reference.
Okay, Fangraphs has McCutchen a little bit above, but either way, you're looking at guys who are basically around 8. And so Mike Trout was basically Carlos Beltran better than the next best guy. I have to put it in player form. He was Carlos Beltran better than every other human being on the planet right now playing baseball, and he doesn't get an MVP award because people like John Heyman are total buffoons.
That's why I like Ken Rosenthal so much. He actually knows what he's talking about.
Ken Rosenthal has a soul.
And, you know, I'm kind of disappointed in John Heyman because he's usually, you know, very on top of that kind of stuff and doesn't make...
He's at least open to it.
Yeah, and I'm not really used to John Heyman, you know, being that naive on stuff like that. And just... I don't get it because... You take all the factors of an individual. Do I need to spell that out again? Individual.
Well, I mean, you could spell it, but the people who are arguing with you probably don't know if it's spelled right or not.
Because I'm sorry, it is exactly the Cy Young Award. It is exactly just that, only usually with hitters. And to give Cabrera that over Trout 2 years in a row... What are you doing?
My mind is just so boggled right now. I can't even comprehend how a person could do that. Like, this information is available to you. Okay, you may use it. Why you are choosing to ignore it, I have absolutely no idea. And not only that, but you could just look at the stats, okay? Trout last year was equally as good of a hitter as Cabrera. And he played a phenomenal center field while Cabrera was an embarrassment at third base. Trout is an elite quality, all-generation type base runner. I can run the bases faster backwards than Cabrera can. And this year, Cabrera's base running was, again, pathetic. His defense got worse because he's old and he should be playing first base or DHing. Honestly, the Tigers have 3 DHs, and they have to figure that situation out.
Yeah, they do.
And Trout, again, good defender. Again, phenomenal base runner. Playing a tougher position offensively than Cabrera. And posts similar numbers to Cabrera. I don't understand why it's so hard for people to wrap their... I mean, this isn't even, like, numbers, because it's just very simple, like, logic to get to that conclusion. You don't even need to use war to get to the same conclusion. But war is there to help you get to the conclusion because it does the math for you, so you don't have to try and rationalize it in your head.
Yeah, I just... I don't know, Ryan. It just kind of... It just makes my mind want to explode sometimes because...
All the anger.
All of the anger. And I'll tell you what...
Ike Davis would be upset.
Ike Davis would be very upset. He and Mark Ellis. They're probably talking to each other right now. Oh, man, I'm just so upset about this.
Yes.
But... I'll tell you another award I was actually really happy with, and a lot of people really don't like it. I'm sorry. I love the fact that Terry Francona won AL Manager of the Year. He deserved that more than anything. Now, obviously, I would have thrown some votes Joe Girardi's way.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, out of the managers that were there, I mean, if they would have given it to Farrell, I probably would have just rage quit baseball. I'm sorry.
Yeah. He had the best team in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and that's what kills me. It's like, oh, he brought them from last to first. Look at the talent that's on that team regardless. You have a team with Dustin Pedroia, Jacoby Ellsbury, David Ortiz, John Lester, Jared Saltalamacchia, eventually Xander Bogaerts.
A team in which Daniel Nava was a really good player, and he was, like, not getting every day at bats. That's how good that team was.
Yeah, so don't feed me that crap that, oh, well, he brought them from last to first. No, it was because they hated Bobby Valentine, they didn't want to play for him, and they wanted to play for a manager they wanted to respect.
Everybody and their mother got hurt last year. That team was so decimated by injuries last year, and then when they were coming back, they're still not healthy players. There was a massive underperformance by everyone. Everything that could have possibly gone wrong for Bobby Valentine went wrong, and plus the players just... didn't like him.
Oh, they hated him.
And then everything that possibly could have gone right for Farrell went right, and it wasn't because he was this, you know, such a more phenomenal manager than Bobby Valentine, because I think Valentine's a fine manager, but that situation was just awful.
Oh, he didn't have much of a chance to really do anything.
Because they didn't want Francona gone in the first place.
And that's the thing, is managers like Terry Francona, managers like Joe Girardi, are good managers, because... they take what they have, and they work with it well. Francona, yeah, the only additions Cleveland really got this season were Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne. To work with that and still take a team that had a shoddy rotation into the playoffs, I'm sorry, that really deserves it. And not only that, but the fact that... On September 29th, when Major League Baseball ended its regular season, the Indians were one game behind the Tigers in the AL Central. One game!
People don't realize that because the Tigers clinched it up so early, and then the Indians got, like, white hot the last 2 weeks of the season.
They won 10 straight. And that's why I wanted Francona to win so badly, because he is such a good manager. He knows how to take a team and make them good. You know, Joe Girardi in New York, he almost got to the playoffs with more than half that team just kind of dead. I mean, respect there. But, I'm sorry, the fact that Don Mattingly was on the NL, you know, ballot for that is laughable.
There wasn't a single NL manager that deserved to win that award. They were all bad. Every one of those managers was bad. They made bad decisions. Because it's so hard for me. I think Manager of the Year is kind of a silly award because I don't know how to, or like, for me to have a strong opinion on it is very hard because what is really important, we can't see, and when we make these, like, assertions, it's a lot of assumptions. But from what I do, I like to look at the manager and be like, okay, well, I can understand his decision-making, and then if the player says he's a good leader, or if there's, like, particularly bad leadership, which would never put you in the Manager of the Year situation in the first place, then I take that into account. But when it came to in-game management, every single manager in the National League last year was not very good.
Yeah, I mean, especially Mattingly. Mattingly it has, like, the perpetual, like, deer in the headlights look because that Dodgers team was terrible. And then not just Puig, what everybody thinks, but Hanley Ramirez. Yes, thank you. Hanley Ramirez helped that team get back to where they needed to go. Not to mention Magic Johnson's wallet that opened up and, you know, got Hyunjin Ryu there and Ricky Nolasco there and Zach Greinke there. So yeah, that helped as well. Mike Matheny just ran into that team that Tony La Russa had, and Clinton Hurdle just happened to run into
a turnkey operation.
Yeah, and Clinton Hurdle just happened to have a good team this year. So it's not like they did anything spectacular like, you know, what Bob Melvin did in Oakland or what Joe Girardi did in New York, or what Terry Francona did in Cleveland. And it's just, yeah, I kind of have to agree there. The manager of the year is just a really weird and kind of nonsensical award because it can be purely based on luck sometimes. It really can. And that's
I think 90% of manager of the year is totally like luck-based because we're like, okay, what were expectations for this team? And it's not even like it's mainstream expectations, which, okay, oh, they're the Pirates. They'll never, ever be good at baseball ever again, despite everything they might ever do. Oh, hey, the Pirates made the playoffs. This manager is a genius. That's like, literally their rationale to giving Hurdle the manager of the year. Now, the one thing I will give to Hurdle that he did a phenomenal job on is his starting pitchers threw the fewest pitches in Major League Baseball, which people are like, oh my God, this is awful. No, this is actually genius. Because pitchers, the deeper they pitch into games, the least effective they are. Every time you roll through the lineup, hitters improve. Despite, like, you know, you got to get to this guy early. That's totally false. If you're listening to this podcast, please don't ever, ever tell anyone that. Let anyone tell you that. Ever believe that. Because data has shown that each time you go through the lineup, the hitters improve. And especially once you hit the third time through the lineup, there's this pretty fairly significant jump. And so he's avoiding having his starting pitchers pitch, in a lot of cases, deep through a third time through the lineup while getting the bullpen in there. They're seeing guys who specialize. You have a lot of fastball. That Pirates bullpen was amazing. Mm-hmm. And so he got them into the game. People like, oh, you're going to burn out your bullpen. Well, if you manage the bullpen correctly, which he did a very good job of managing the bullpen, which I think is why I would have given him the award, because that was one thing he did very well, is he managed the bullpen and kept his starters protected from basically math and let his bullpen eat up more innings, and that was very effective. And that's why they had a very good pitching staff. It wasn't that they had necessarily more elite pitchers, although Francisco Liriano, remembering that, you know, 2007 happened, was kind of a plus for him, and Burnett, you know, not aging was pretty cool for him.
And Jeff Locke being kind of good at the first
half. Jeff Locke all of a sudden being an all-star for a half a year and then disappearing off the face of the earth. But he managed the bullpen well in itself, and then the way he used the bullpen to complement a starting rotation that he didn't let go really deep into games. Like, people want to rip on Renicky for pitch counts. Okay, pitch count is a little bit silly, but protecting your rotation from itself is a great way to, I mean, it's very small differences, but it's a very good way to win. It gets you an extra couple wins. And in the American League side, I'm always partial to the A's, so Bob Melvin will always, because the way he's able to manage the platoons, will always hold a soft spot in my heart for a manager able to manage that kind of a situation. But I have no problem giving it to, I mean, if Francona who did win it, totally fine with that, totally see the reason for it, and totally behind that. If Girardi would have actually got on the ballot, like, he should have been. John Farrell shouldn't have been on the ballot. It should have been Francona, Girardi, and Melvin. And if Girardi would have won it, I would have been like, yes, because he almost got that team to the playoffs despite a absolute dumpster fire in the Bronx. And then Melvin for being able to manage what is an under-payroll team, again, a team that was heavily reliant on platoons, and he was able to keep the clubhouse very satisfied. You never heard a single word come out of Oakland that anyone was dissatisfied with playing time. Mm-hmm. And he also was able to manage a bullpen that was kind of, I mean, there was Balfour in the closer's role, but Balfour isn't the hashtag proven closer, which is a total myth too. If you're listening, please don't ever believe in proven closer, because Koji Uehara happened. And so Bob Melvin being able to manage a bullpen in Oakland, obviously, because they recycle through relievers like nobody's business. And just being able to patch that together, I also like. So the AL, there were three good candidates. And obviously Joe Maddon is always in there, but I feel like Maddon will just win the AL Manager of the Year until he dies, so we do have to give it to someone else occasionally.
That is true.
And so in the NL, Clint Hurdle is the only one that I could possibly ever make a case for, because the other ones, there was nothing that was like, yes, this guy showed, from what I could see,
that he helped the team win games outside the clubhouse, which I can't see. And there was never anything out of the clubhouse in Pittsburgh that said, oh, Clint Hurdle's hurting us. If anything, it was Clint Hurdle is helping us. And in the American League, for some reason, every single year seems to have, you know, better managers as far as tactician, which I think is some of it is because the American League has a DH, which is a totally different topic. I think the NL should have a DH to avoid these silly conundrums you're putting managers in, and why would I want to watch Ben Sheets swing a baseball bat?
That's never a pretty sight.
No, it's when Ben Sheets got a bunt for a base hit, might have been the greatest moment of my life. But yeah, I mean, there's a multitude of American League managers. There's basically Clint Hurdle in the National League, and I'm totally fine with Francona winning it and then Hurdle winning it. So they got the manager of the year right, but just the rationale that they used to get to those things is not always right, in my opinion.
Just a side note, I did hear people like say that Koji Uehara is the Japanese version of Mariano Rivera. The next person that says that is getting decked in the throat. I'm not lying.
Wait. So a guy who never closed until this year
for half a season
is the same guy that's been closing since he came out of diapers.
Yeah, people actually said that, and I wanted to hit all of them in the face very hardly. I think hardly is a word.
As far as like reliever value, yeah, they're actually both really, really good, and they've both been really, really good for several years, except nobody notices Koji because he doesn't have the hashtag proven closer moniker to go with him that Rivera has had, and Rivera has earned, even though proven closer really isn't a thing to earn. Rivera's just been awesome, and so is Uehara, but to people comparing the two is kind of silly because while they're both elite relievers, I don't know how combining them together and saying that Koji Uehara is Mariano Rivera is the Japanese Mariano Rivera, that doesn't make, like, I don't know how a person would come to that conclusion.
Yeah, that's just like,
I mean, they're totally different pitchers. One's a fastball splitter guy, and one guy throws a cutter, and that's it. If you want to talk about Mariano Rivera, let's talk about Kenley Jansen. That guy is Mariano Rivera in L.A. He throws one pitch, and he throws it really well. And Jansen, if Mattingly doesn't decide to try and Brandon League closing again, then
because
Jansen,
that happened.
Yeah, that was a terrible signing when it happened, and it blew up in his face like it rightfully should have. And then Kenley Jansen was like, hey, I'm going to be like one of the best relievers in all of baseball, like obviously I have been. And you haven't been using me right. Use me as the relief ace. And then they finally use them as managers like to use their relief aces, which is a totally different theoretical discussion for a different day. But actually used him in the closer's role, and he was shocking. Awesome. Like, the closer, like, yeah, I'm going to rant about closers, so let's stop this.
All right.
I can't rant about closers. I'll be here for 3 hours.
Well, we're going to get into our last topic right now, which really isn't even baseball-related. It's still sports-related, so I'm just going to go down a list of the NFL games this weekend, and Ryan, you're going to tell me who you think is going to win each game.
So, okay.
All right, so first game on the list is New York Jets at Buffalo Bills.
Wow, that's really exciting. That's
terribly exciting.
The Jets, I guess, because the Bills just seem to be spinning their wheels.
All right, Baltimore Ravens at Chicago Bears.
Do we have if Jay Cutler's starting, I want to take the Ravens, but if Josh McCown is starting, I kind of want to take the Bears.
I do not know who's starting that game.
And I know because Cutler was he had an ankle problem, which my Bears roommate said may not have actually been an ankle problem, but really a cover for his groin not being totally all the way back yet. But I'll make that caveat. If McCown's the quarterback, I'll take the Bears. But if Cutler's the quarterback, I'll take the Ravens.
All right. Cleveland Browns and Cincinnati Bengals.
Cincinnati. Cleveland without Brian Hoyer is not good.
All right. Washington Redskins at Philadelphia Eagles.
I'm going to take Philly. I believe in Nick Foles, even though like some of his throws against Green Bay last week were interceptions waiting to happen. Washington's secondary is worse than Green Bay's, like significantly. Like that is the worst secondary in the NFL. And Nick Foles will carve them up for a bajillion touchdowns and not throw an interception.
And I need LeSean McCoy to do well for my fantasy team.
That's always a plus. Okay. Watching McCoy is frustrating when you're the opposing team because he will be totally bottled up and then just spread out to the side and run for 15 yards.
All right, Detroit.
Sure, why not?
Detroit Lions at Pittsburgh Steelers.
Detroit. Pittsburgh's a dumpster fire.
Atlanta Falcons at Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Wow.
There's another barn burner of a game.
I'm gonna take the Falcons because.
Okay.
It's not gonna be by a lot, but I mean the Bucs have incentive to lose this game so they can get Teddy Bridgewater. So, I mean, of course Shiano has to know he's fired, right?
Yeah, I would think so at this point.
And so, I mean, the GM probably doesn't last either. So, I mean, maybe they're just trying to sabotage the Bridgewater thing. But as a Buccaneers fan, if there are any Brewer Buccaneers fans listening, root for your team to lose every single game this season so you can get a real quarterback. It's really cool. Trust me.
They might not because I think Tony Gonzalez is going to be out for Atlanta. So,
well, I mean. I'm going to take Atlanta, but it's not going to be. It's going to be a really ugly game. Those are two very bad football teams.
Okay, well, be prepared for this one. Arizona Cardinals at Jacksonville Jaguars.
I'm actually going to take the Cardinals. Like, I don't think that should be a huge problem game. The Cardinals are actually not playing that bad, despite Carson Palmer kind of forgetting that he is Carson Palmer and was once good. He's been playing a little bit better of late, apparently. One of my Twitter people who does football stuff says Palmer's play has been improving, but he's still not 2005 Carson Palmer anymore. So, but they can beat the Jaguars because that's a very bad football team.
Terrible. They don't even have a win yet, I think.
No, they got to win. Will Blackman? Yeah, Will Blackman, that dude.
Oh, yeah, they beat
right before time expired. And they notched a win, and they cost themselves Teddy Bridgewater in the process.
All right.
So way to go, Will Blackman.
Oakland Raiders at Houston Texans.
Case Keenum is good. Like, Case Keenum will be playing quarterback for Houston for several years.
Is he the next Aaron Rodgers?
No, he's not the next Aaron Rodgers. But Case Keenum is certainly better than Matt Schaub, and Terrell Pryor has been... Like, you think that... The Packers quarterback situation has been bad the last few weeks. Terrell Pryor has been worse than what you have witnessed as a Packers fan.
He's been Oakland's quarterback, I think, mostly all season.
Terrell Pryor has been the worst quarterback in the NFL the last month, and it's not even remotely close. He is worse than any combination of Vikings quarterback, Packer backups. I mean, he's been atrocious passing the ball. It's hard to comprehend how an NFL quarterback could be that bad passing, but he has been.
Plus, Run DMC might be out this week, so I definitely would probably give that game to Houston as well. All right, San Diego at Miami.
San Diego's a better football team. And people want to say the whole Miami bullying situation is affecting. When you're actually playing on the field, it doesn't actually, like, from playing sports, when you're actually, like, playing... And especially in a game in football where you are like, it's not like playing baseball where I'm standing in the outfield and between pitches there's 20 seconds for me to think. When you're playing football, you are focused on the play that's being called, your checks once you break the huddle, and then physically beating yourself against another human being. And then when you go to the sidelines, you are discussing everything that went on the field and adjustments you are making. There is no downtime in a football game for you to let your mind wander off to other things. You are constantly mentally engaged. So Miami, the reason Miami loses will not be because of the bullying effect. It's because San Diego is a significantly better football team.
Yeah, and Phillip Rivers has looked pretty good this year.
Yeah, with his Scott Tolzien throwing motion.
All right, Minnesota Vikings at Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, the Seahawks will roll.
Yeah, that's Seattle, so they know how good their secondary is at home.
Sure. Wow, a Vikings quarterback throwing against a Seattle Seahawks secondary has to be the most unfair matchup of the entire season.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's Ponder or Josh Freeman. They're not going to have a fun Sunday.
Does it matter?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. They're not going to have a fun Sunday.
They're both not good. Like, people keep trying to show all these things that says Josh Freeman, he could be good. Well, I think it's not a physical issue with Josh Freeman. He has the arm strength. He's decently mobile. He's just, you know, not
good.
Let's just say he's not Peyton Manning when it comes to football IQ.
That is fair. All right, here's one that I think we both know how it's going to end. Green Bay Packers at New York Giants.
The Packers will beat the Giants.
I hope so.
Okay, let's be fair to okay. Scott Tolzien had 6 practice reps last week. And if it wasn't for Mason Crosby, like, getting wind screwed by swirling winds inside Lambeau Field, because every single one he had was, like, the one he even had right was hooking in and got pulled back out by the wind. And the other one he missed was going right down and got pushed out. It was to the same direction, the wind, every single time. So if he doesn't get wind screwed and has more than 6 reps that week, they probably actually beat the Eagles, which is a weird concept to think about.
I don't know. The Giants have won their last 3 games in a row after losing their first 6, so I think they have some momentum. I would love to see the Packers win this game, but I don't know.
If the Packers win this game, I will feel a lot better about our playoff chances. I'm just going to see who the Giants have actually played last couple weeks, because that could have a fairly big impact as to whether or not they've actually been beating anyone worth beating, or if they've just been beating on the low end of the NFL.
They beat Minnesota, Philly, and Oakland.
Yeah, so I'm really not impressed by any of that.
All right.
I'm going to take Green Bay over the Giants, because Scott Tolzien will actually have practice reps, and the Giants haven't been able to generate pass rush basically the whole season. That secondary is not very good. The entire defense is basically, like, below average at every level. And so, not only Tolzien, but the running game has been elite. The Packers' running game has been elite. When's the last time? Like, in my lifetime, I've never been able to really say that.
Yeah, Eddie Lacy's been fun to watch.
All over the Giants. And the Giants are basically completely reliant on Eli Manning's arm. And he likes to throw a lot of interceptions, and even though the Packers haven't generated a lot of turnovers, they've been in positions to generate a lot of turnovers and just haven't actually made the catch, or Morgan Burnett decides to just nick the ball slightly out of Tremont Williams' hands into DeSean Jackson's waiting lap. And so I think the Packers will be able to beat the Giants this week.
All right, next game, which I think could be the matchup of the week, is San Francisco and New Orleans.
New Orleans wins that game. San Francisco hasn't been what they were, like, touted up to be exactly this year, and New Orleans just did a number on Dallas. They basically embarrassed Dallas. And Dallas is not a bad football team. They just keep shooting themselves in the foot. But it was impressive the way New Orleans just completely dismantled Dallas.
All right, your Sunday night game is Kansas City Chiefs, the undefeated Kansas City Chiefs, at Denver.
Denver, like...
Yeah.
Kansas City just doesn't impress me. Like, they have a nice defense, but... I mean, they don't have a nice defense. They have a very good defense. And Jamal Charles is a very good running back, but... I struggle to see Denver not being able to put up more than 24 points. And I struggle to see Kansas City being able to put up more than that. I feel like Kansas City needs to win games 24-17. And you'll be able to tell early who's going to probably win this game. If it's low scoring, Kansas City has a significant advantage. But if it starts turning into a shootout, it's over. Because yeah. Alex Smith is not going toe-to-toe with Peyton Manning.
And then your Monday night game is the New England Patriots at the Carolina Panthers.
I'm taking Carolina.
It won't be a pretty win, but yeah, I have to take Carolina as well.
I am surprised that you took Carolina. I thought I was going to be going out on a limb there. Apparently, I'm just not.
Carolina has one of the best defenses this season.
We're out of nowhere. Secondary last year was pathetic. And all of a sudden, they're like, hey, the front seven's doing a lot of it. But the secondary has been pretty good.
I mean, they're 6-3. They're only a game behind the Saints. And, I mean, they've just looked like a football team, like they haven't in the past few years, but so
yeah, it's been fairly impressive the way they've been able to basically turn around and without really adding much, kind of go from not very good to a team that would scare me in the playoffs. Like, I would not want, I don't want to play Carolina. They are a good football team with a chance to be an even better football team than they're playing right now.
Yeah.
Get Cam Newton another receiver.
Oh my God, you know how good they would be then?
Well, can you imagine everyone in Madden would be playing with Carolina?
Yeah, that's something I thought I would never hear, so. Well, now that we got our football predictions out of the way, I think we're pretty good for tonight, so.
Remember, this podcast was brought to you in part by Ike Davis.
And Mark Ellis.
Yes.
With a hint of Scott Kazmir, so.
With a small contribution from Scott Kazmir.
Yes. So, we will have our next podcast in about the middle of December. The GM meetings will be ending soon, so maybe we'll see something from the Brewers happening then. Then we'll have the winter meetings ending after, you know, I think, what is that, the first week of December? So we'll
I
want to
say it's
that.
Like, yeah, it's within the first 10 days of December, so we'll be podcasting in like the either the middle of the GM or the winter meetings or the end, so there will be at least, you know, something to talk about. There will be action, whether it be Ike Davis related or not.
Yeah, so if it is, if it isn't, we can't tell you right now. So until then, thank you for listening and stay tuned as always.